outskirts of Minneapolis, Minnesota. It's That's the Thing, the film podcast where twin critics talk about, well, what else films. I'm your co-host, Nick Cooey. Join me, as always, is Alex Cooey. We are just situated here on February the 14th, this very frigid Valentine's Day, I should say. I mean, well, but it's been very frigid out here in the Twin Cities, Alex. It's been, what, 20 degrees below zero consistently?
Yeah, something like that. If you don't account for the wind chill, then it's like negative 30, 50.
Oh, yeah, exactly. You just keep the wind chill, you know, and then you'll be able to stay outside for 10 minutes instead of just 2 minutes.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been very, very cold over here in Minneapolis. So we've been, well, in all of Minnesota, really. So we've been housebound and trying to kind of stay busy with whatever we can to stave off cabin fever. And that's included planning out what is going to be a miniseries for this year, which is our 1991 retrospective. And we've picked 1991 for a couple of reasons. One, because it is 30 years. And secondly, because it was the year that we were both born in. So, I mean, that's a little weird to think, turning 30 at the end of this year.
Yeah, I mean, we'll cross that bridge once we get there. But you're right, it is a bit surreal to think.
Well, yeah, this whole project is just kind of like a coping mechanism, I guess.
Well, there's no better form of therapy than cinema.
Is that true, though? I mean, I don't know. I think we can talk about a lot of filmmakers who have taken that caveat to heart and then, or that maxim to heart, and then, you know. But in any case, you know, we were talking a lot about what we wanted to discuss for this series. And there was one title that we decided that we had to kind of raise up because it is so ubiquitous within popular culture, and for us as well. It was kind of a formative film when we were very young, and I mean, as really, really, you know, when we were in our nascent stages of cinephilia. I mean, this film was kind of a cornerstone, and that is, of course, Disney's 1991 film adaptation of Beauty and the Beast, which, I mean, and that's kind of, and I mean, it's not, the reason I want to, you know, the kind of the difficulty with this episode, Alex, is just sort of figuring out about what we can say about this movie, rather than that there's nothing to say about it, because, I don't know, maybe you feel differently than I do, but I feel like that there's been a lot that's, this, understandably, that's been written about and discussed about this particular adaptation of the fairy tale.
Well, you know, I feel yes. And but, you know, I still think it's important to raise up because of how significant and influential the film has been, not just for us or for the generation of kids who grew up with this movie, but also how it kind of helped to shape the Disney Renaissance that lasted through the 90s, as well as kind of, I think, informed and influenced the kinds of Disney films that would be developed long afterwards. So films like Frozen, for instance.
Sure, sure, absolutely. And I mean, and yeah, because this wasn't the first film in the Disney Renaissance, as a lot of people kind of attribute either the first to being Who Framed Roger Rabbit or The Little Mermaid, but Beauty and the Beast was definitely the one that it cemented Disney's comeback after what had been a pretty long period of them in some form of cultural limbo, I'd like to say.
I mean, it was a very dark age for them, like in the 80s. Like, it was...
Well, the 70s, too.
Yes, and the 70s. Basically, after Walt Disney's death in 1966, there was a kind of identity crisis, and it came to the point where actually some people were considering closing the animation department.
Yeah, which, I mean, I think is really interesting now, in the year 2020, to think about Disney doing that is unspeakable, since they're kind of they're conquering the planet, one corporation or one company that they, you know, acquire into their monopoly at a time.
And this was a studio which sunk so low that their big release, The Black Cauldron, 1985, was beaten at the box office by the Care Bears movie.
Yeah, so it's very difficult to even conceptualize that a movie like Beauty and the Beast was really sort of this huge statement for a studio that had, as we've been saying, been something of a creative rut and a financial rut, you know, let's be honest, for the better part of two decades. But, I mean, before we kind of get into the history of Disney's Beauty and the Beast, I feel like it might be important to kind of talk a little bit about the original story. And of course, there's the whole truism uttered in the famous lyrics of Tale as Old as Time, but it really is actually, when you get down to it, a tale as old as time. Because some of the tropes that were prevalent, or present, I should say, in the fairy tale of Beauty and the Beast, were kind of can be traced to a couple of different stories. I mean, the first and the oldest is the one of Cupid and Psyche, which was written by Platonicus in the 2nd century AD. And that was for Metamorphoses, or the Golden Ass, as it was called by other authors later on. And it's the only work of ancient Roman literature in Latin which has survived in its entirety. And I mean, kind of the most pertinent detail about that fable is that Psyche is, she's married to a husband who she is forbidden from seeing. And when her vain sisters claim that she's either lying about being married or positing that perhaps her spouse is a hideous monster, she takes a peek at him and sees that her spouse is indeed Cupid, who's enormously handsome. But upon seeing him, he subsequently vanishes, and then Psyche has to regain his trust and his love through a series of trials that she undergoes. And this structure of the tale, or this tale, I should say, would be echoed several hundred years later, leaping ahead into the late 17th century by Marie-Catherine d'Aulnoy in The Green Serpent, or Le Serpentin Vert. And I think it's important to kind of jump ahead into European literature as it relates to fairy tales. Because, I mean, there was in the middle of the last millennium, I should say, there was sort of this surfeit of fairy tales that were being written and produced throughout Europe. And one of the seminal texts during this period was The Pig King. It's an Italian fairy tale, Il Re Porco, and it was written by Giovanni Francesco Straparola in his two-volume collection of short stories, which was called The Facetious Knight of Straparola. And that's essentially about, it's actually a rather gruesome tale, about this young king, or this prince, who is a pig. He's born a pig, and he's raised into adulthood, and this prophecy deems that he will only turn back into a human after being thrice married, and the first two wives that he marries unfortunately are killed by him impaling them on his hooves, and thankfully that doesn't happen with the third one. But then what he does is he just like slips on his own, this pig skin, on and off, like when it's like daytime versus nighttime, when he transforms back into a human being. It's a very weird story.
I don't know, it sounds like your typical European fairy tale.
Oh yeah, well, you know, the Europeans, though, they did, I mean, especially when we go back to the French writers like Charles Perrault, I mean, you know, you read something like Cinderella and Peau d'Âne. I mean, those stories have some very dark, often gruesome elements in them.
It's macabre, to say the very least.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, and that's no different with Beauty and the Beast,
which was originally written by Gabrielle Suzanne Barbeau de Villeneuve in 1740. And the story of Beauty and the Beast was originally published in The Young American and Marine Tales.
But the most famous version, the one that most people know, was published 16 years later by Jean-Marie Le Prince de Beaumont in Le Magasin des Enfants. And this is an important distinction that I'll kind of bring up later of its publication. But basically, she was retelling the story to a readership of mostly young girls. And the original story, the 1740 version, she had to condense that down quite a bit because it was actually at over 100 pages. And it had it was inundated with very dense detail about the story. And Le Prince de Beaumont essentially condensed it to its most archetypal ingredients. And she also omitted some of the more overtly bawdy parts of the story. For example, in the original tale, the beast actually asks Belle to sleep with him every night, and to which he refuses. But then in the Le Prince de Beaumont version, it's just simply he continuously asks her to marry him. So, yeah. I mean, I know it's not as child-friendly, but yeah, these fairy tales weren't always child-friendly. And I think it's just kind of important to mention that just the publication history of the Le Prince de Beaumont version, because as she notes in her introduction to her book, Beauty and the Beast, Classic Tales About Animal Brides and Grooms, Maria Tatar argues that the story, while it is one about, quote, the transformative power of empathy, it was designed in part to prepare young girls for arranged marriages. Which, I don't know about you, Alex, but like, even though they didn't immediately leap out to me, like, but hearing about that, I'm not terribly surprised. But I think it's also important to note that, I think the reason why the story has persisted beyond that, I think Tatar actually pinpointed this very nicely, where she said actually in an interview with Kelly Faircloth for Jezebel that she argued that the story of Beauty and the Beast is fundamentally about, quote, our relationship to alterity and monstrosity. And I think that that's kind of carried through in many, many adaptations from all over the world. And I mean, it's been retold through many, many versions, which, I mean, we could get into, we could fill out the entire episode talking about. I mean, from East Asia to all the way to the Iberian Peninsula. I mean, the Russian writer Sergei Aksakov rewrote the story in 1858 with The Scarlet Flower, and the American writer Laura E. Richards rewrote the story in 1886. But the story wouldn't be, it wouldn't be adapted in another medium outside of literature until the 20th century. And that's where two very important figures come in. One is Walt Disney, and the other is a figure who's very well known in literary circles in the early 20th century in France, Jean Cocteau.
Indeed. Yes. In fact, actually, Jean Cocteau's version of the Beauty and the Beast, which he made in the mid-40s, is arguably the second most well-known cinematic adaptation of the story outside of the Disney version.
And it's the first, if I'm not mistaken, isn't it?
Yes, I believe it is. You know, and it's kind of interesting because, Cocteau's version was so influential and so significant that actually Walt himself had attempted to adapt, you know, when he was looking at different fairy tales to adapt when he was starting, forming his company into making feature-length films, like after Snow White, and he was looking for the next project. In the 30s, he actually was considering adapting Beauty and the Beast, and he attempted to develop it in the 30s, but he and his story team never really got far with it. And then he attempted it again in the 1950s, but there was a lack of success there. And Peter M. Nichols of the New York Times theorized that maybe that Walt abandoned trying to attempt adapting the story altogether because he felt like maybe he couldn't compete with the Cocteau version.
Well, the Cocteau version, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, we are talking about the Disney version today, but I think it's just important to note that the Cocteau version, you know, you watch it 75 years later after release, and it is still an absolute marvel on a technical level in terms of just the scope of imagination that Cocteau was able to achieve. I mean, he did set a really high bar with it, even though, you know, long before Disney finally did get to make Beauty and the Beast, several other adaptations were mounted of the story, I mean, particularly in television. And, I mean, some of them are kind of well-known, like the Ron Perlman TV series of Beauty and the Beast, which I've still never seen, but from what I understand, it's very, very loosely rooted in the original story.
Yeah, well, there's that. And then on the other spectrum, you have the Canon Films adaptation.
Oh, right, with John Savage.
Yes.
when you have the same, kind of outfit that did the Christopher Walken Puss in Boots fairy tale, you can only expect nothing but the highest quality.
Indeed. Which I think that's a good moment, anyway, to segue to then how, like, the Disney version really got its start, when it finally began to get off the ground. And because, like I said, there were a couple efforts before during Walt's lifetime, but that never really came to fruition. But it really wasn't until 1987 when, while they were making Who Framed Roger Rabbit, actually, that Disney studio decided to give it another go. But here, you know, with this Beauty and the Beast, the first person they actually offered to the directorial job to was Richard Williams, who at the time was working as animation director in Who Framed Roger Rabbit. But Richard declined the offer because he preferred to work on his longest-dating masterpiece, The Thief and the Cobbler.
Right, and he was only able to really kind of secure a lot of the funding for that film after the success of Roger Rabbit.
Exactly. But Williams did recommend to the studio a fellow colleague of his who worked on Roger Rabbit as director, Richard Purdom. So he was assigned to direct the film. And it was during that time that Michael Eisner ordered that they should hire an animation screenwriter to take over, which was unusual for the time because, for those who don't know, animation doesn't necessarily, like when it comes to stories, animation is quite different from live action films because they don't usually like start off with a script. They have like story teams that come together and they like storyboard the whole film. But really it was, so Beauty and the Beast was the first time that they actually hired a screenwriter to write a script at the get-go before having it storyboarded, and they hired Linda Wolverton, who at the time had worked on TV shows for Disney like Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers.
I mean, that's interesting, you know. I mean, because, well, yeah, it's been a few years since I've seen Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers, but I can't recall there's anything in particular that would seem to me to leap out as, oh, this person would be, this is who we're going to get to be not only just like the first woman screenwriter of an animated film, but just the first screenwriter officially of an animated film ever. And I mean, it's interesting if you watch the film now in the credits, she's listed under animation screenplay, you know, which I think is, it's very unusual, but I mean, it's a really fascinating bit of history as well.
Oh, yes, indeed. Well, there are quite a few other people, too, that I think, you know, when they were being hired, it's like, really, these people? But, you know, we'll get into some of those later. Mm-hmm. Because then, you know, they, at this, because this early version actually was a non-musical, and they made a storyboard reel of it. And it was a bit different from the final film version that we got. Like, actually, it was a little closer to the Cocktail film. Like, it had, like, Belle had a younger sister. The antagonist, Gaston, was more of, like, basically an aristocratic fop, and her dad, I remember reading in the making of book, even seeing character designs, they said he looks more like Jack Lemmon than he does in the film.
Did they try to get Jack Lemmon to play him?
I don't know. Like, when watching this, because I saw the storyboard reel, like, there, it's like a 20-30 minutes, the first 20-30 minutes of this version that they did a storyboard reel.
I see. Okay.
And you can see it on YouTube. And we'll get to that response in a sec, but, you know, there's also other details, too. Like, there were also sentient objects, but they didn't talk, so that was a little closer to the Cocteau version, though they didn't have that, maybe that surreal quality quite like in Cocteau's.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, the Cocteau version did kind of deviate from the Prince version in several ways, and one of them, yeah, is the incorporation of sentient objects like the candelabra, that are the arms holding these candles that light the way down these dark gothic passageways. I mean, it gives this sort of disturbing organic element to the castle itself. And also, he introduces the character of Amenant, who is something of, yeah, kind of an early forerunner for the character of Gaston in the Disney version.
Yes, indeed. So, yeah, so it's interesting that some elements still survive that of Cocteau's influence in this final film. But so they screened, like, the storyboard reels to Jeffrey Katzenberg, and he was not pleased with it, like, at all. He told them, like, you know, scrap it. You got to start all over again. And I've seen it on YouTube, as I said, and it's boring, for like a better term. Mm-hmm. I mean, one person who was involved with the film actually described pretty well, saying it was nice looking, but it kind of looked like animated masterpiece theater.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, which, I don't know, that just doesn't feel very riveting.
No, especially for what we would kind of understand as a Disney project.
Exactly. So they decided to restart all over again, and Purdom decided to depart from the project as director, so they were, like, trying to find somebody else to replace him. And so they decided to hire then-newcomers like animators Kirk Wise and Gary Trousdale, who had previously also worked... Their only work as directors had been on the animated sections of this Epcot attraction called Cranium Command, which, you know, I just watched some of it earlier, and it would seem unusual, like, to go from that to a full-length animated feature film. But also, Cranium Command was a project which had been struggling to get off the ground for a while, and actually they had did a turnaround, and they were in a very limited number of time before they could reach the deadline. So Trousdale and Wise stepped up to direct that, and they were able to meet the deadline in time. So I think they figured, oh, then these guys can help deliver a project.
Yeah, on a time and budget crunch.
Exactly, because then the production ended up being only like 2 years before the film came out. So, you know, which is like half of the typical production length of an animated feature. Mm-hmm. And plus, they also decided to assign, because they were working on The Little Mermaid at the time, composer Alan Menken and lyricist Howard Ashman, who also produced Little Mermaid. And, you know, Little Mermaid became the huge success that really instigated the Disney Renaissance as we know it. But there was some personal drama going behind the scenes that not even everyone at the studio was aware of. Like, mm-hmm. Because Howard Ashman had, in 1988, he'd actually secretly learned that he had been diagnosed with AIDS. And so he tried to keep that a secret from everyone. But
except as the story goes, I know that didn't he confide in Alan Menken when they won the Oscar?
It wasn't until, 2 years later, like, it was just after they won the Oscars that then he did confide to Alan when they went back to New York, and he did tell him, like, I'm sick, I'm HIV positive.
I see.
And then, you know, when they offered Beauty and the Beast to them, Howard was initially reluctant to sign on board because he had been developing Aladdin. You know, and that was a project that it was like a passion project for him. Like he had written an outline, a story treatment for it in like the late 80s, you know, and everything. He was very much gung-ho for that. But then he decided to sign on board. But when he did, he then told Jeffrey Katzenberg what was going on because he felt there was no way he could go around it because it was this point in his health that he felt he couldn't really travel, you know, from New York to California because it would just be too taxing on his health.
Right.
And he was a little surprised. Like, actually, Katzenberg, you know, was very receptive and responsive, you know, to him. Like, I think Al Mencken said, he acted like a Jewish caretaker, like, you know, saying, how's your mother taking this, you know, and what can I do to help? And so he decided, okay, you know, Jeffrey Katzenberg told Ashman, okay, we'll get as much of the production team as we can to fly them to New York and so that you can be able to work from home, but you can still be able to work with us. And we'll, you know, just say, like, well, you're a prima donna, you're a diva, so we'll just throw in that narrative. And so a lot of the crew members weren't aware of Howard's health, and they just thought, oh, well, the mountain comes to Muhammad. But it wasn't until as the production went further and further along and Howard became weaker and weaker, they then realized that something was up.
Well, and it is interesting that, of course, that we kind of have to talk a little bit about Howard Ashman and Alan Menken and their input on the film because, I mean, yeah, it was so instrumental in guiding what would become part of the identity of Beauty and the Beast as a film and as kind of this big media franchise that it would ultimately become. But from what I understand, so Ashman and Menken, as well as Linda Wolverton and the rest of kind of the story team, which numbers, as you can see in the credits, around 10 people, which is kind of crazy, but they all kind of came together to reshape the film. And I understand that there also had to be some revisions that had to be undergone. Like, I know the placement of Be Our Guest was originally designed to be sung to Maurice when he first comes to the castle, but then late in the game, it was changed, wasn't it?
Yeah, like, actually, it was the story goes, one story team member said, you know, maybe I'm crazy, but, you know, I think this would work more if we have the servants sing the song to Belle. And they're like, oh, yeah, that is a great idea. We should do that. Mm-hmm. And actually, even there was a song number called Human Again, which is sung by the servants, you know, as they observe the Beast and Belle falling in love as time passes on. But they felt, the filmmakers felt that would get a little confusing, like, well, how much time has gone by? And so then they changed that. At the 11th hour, they changed it to the song Something There.
But the film was, I mean, they did forge ahead with it. And it was, from what I understand, it was screened first at the New York Film Festival, but in an incomplete version.
Yes, it was. On September 29th, 1991, it was screened in incomplete form at the New York Film Festival with, like, some complete animation, but lots of, like, pencil draw tests and some storyboards,
some animatics.
Yes, animatics basically. Mm-hmm. And but this version, and they knew that they had a hit on their hands because at the end of this screening, the film received a 10-minute standing ovation.
But from what I understand too, so this is the fall of 1991, yeah. And this was already after Howard Ashman had passed away.
Yes, by that time it had been 6 months since Howard died on the 14th of March 1991, at age 40.
So then Beauty and the Beast premieres 2 months later in November of 1991. Mm-hmm. I know it premiered first in the El Capitan Theater before it had a nationwide expansion. And the film cost how much? $25 million, I think? Somewhere that, it's certainly a much, much smaller number than what the Rob Marshall remake from 2017 was.
Bill Condon, please.
Oh, sorry. I don't know why I would ever get those two mixed up.
Well, I mean, they both did Chicago, so.
Well, there you go.
But yeah, you're right. Way cheaper. Yeah, 25 mil. But yeah, no, it was like $25 million, and it made over $100 million, which I think it was also the first Disney animated film to make over $100 million.
It was, and I understand that it was also the third highest grossing domestic feature in 1991 behind Terminator 2 and Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. Which, yeah, it was an interesting year in terms of blockbusters, that's for sure. But yeah, Beauty and the Beast was a huge, huge success. The Celine Dion pop song cover of the title song Beauty and the Beast was actually a big hit single. And, of course, the film made history as the first animated feature film to be nominated for the Best Picture Oscar.
Yes, indeed. And it also was the first animated feature to win the Golden Globe for Best Picture.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, so clearly this film was a huge success, and then it's gone on to inspire sequels, including a really ill-judged Christmas movie.
And an even further ill-judged wannabe TV pilot, Bell's Magical World.
Oh god, I forgot about that, yeah.
And speaking of tacky commercial tie-ins, here's a word from our sponsor.
Pizza Hut wants you to share in the magic of Walt Disney's newest video classic, Beauty and the Beast. Now your kids can collect Beast, Belle, Chip and Cogsworth, each puppet's $1.49 with any pizza purchase. And when you buy the video at your local video store, you get the Pizza Hut value card for great pizza value. So experience the fantasy of Beauty and the Beast, now with Pizza Hut.
But then it also has, as we were saying earlier too, you know, the live-action remake, as well as the stage play, which was also kind of a test run for Disney in terms of breaking into the Broadway scene. Which they would do successfully with The Lion King.
Yeah, but Beauty and the Beast was also a huge hit on Broadway, like ran for a dozen years.
Yeah, yeah, that's not too shabby. That's not too shabby. So, but I mean, but frankly, like, one thing we wanted to do when we were kind of talking about this episode was to really think about Beauty and the Beast as a film, because it is so dwarfed by its legacy in a way, and by the praise it's received from so many people as being ranked among the greatest animated films, if not the greatest animated film of all time. I know, for example, no one less esteemed than Chuck Jones in terms of the animation world praised Beauty and the Beast, and he claimed that the animation of the Beast was among the very best animation he's ever seen in any animated project. And but I for me and for Alex, we were talking about this and we decided that really the way to kind of go about this was to kind of try to look back at the film itself and really think about what we felt about it. So we actually watched it again for the first time last night. And well, how long was it for you, Alex?
Well, I think it was more recent than with you. Like, I actually saw it again less than a year ago.
Oh, okay.
With the family member on VHS.
So, okay. So you watched it on that. Cause we definitely grew up with that. Is that same kind of battered VHS copy that we've kept?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Fantastic. Yeah. Cause we watched the hell out of this copy, you know, over and over and over again. And for me, it actually, the last time I watched it was with a group of people close to a decade ago. So, I mean, of course, though, I had seen the film many, many times, and I thought to myself, is it really necessary that we rewatch this film one more time? But I'm glad we did, personally, because it was good to revisit it and to kind of weigh it as well now 30 years later with a lot of the cultural baggage it's accrued, because the film has attained something of something of a problematic reputation, but which is also kind of linked with the story's roots itself. I mean, I was kind of talking a little bit about that earlier, but I think the story of Beauty and the Beast has been associated with kind of glorifying Stockholm Syndrome for a long, long time, and the notion that, oh, if you simply help treat this abusive person in a nice, loving way, he'll eventually, you know, treat you nicely, and then you'll be able to live happily ever after. And I think, I don't know if that's as much as, but I mean, I do think that that has a root in what I was talking about earlier in terms of just preparing young girls to marry into these often aristocratic families where there is this imbalanced power dynamic. And of course, like, the story has an imbalanced power dynamic, and there's no way to kind of get around that. And but the one thing that I think, of course, is distinguished about the Disney version was its attempt, and this was remarked upon by a lot of critics at the time, its attempt to really have something of a progressive protagonist, a female heroine in the form of Belle, who right from the get-go is established in the opening number that a lot of people have seen, that she's something of a bookworm, but she's a social pariah. You know, she doesn't quite fit in with this community in this small provincial town. And I don't know, Alex, how did you feel about kind of coming back to that character and looking at it now in terms of, like, how Belle as a progressive character has aged over these past 30 years?
Well, you know, I think that's a great question, because I know, and Belle is considered by many to be, like, one of the best Disney heroines, but I think, like, as somebody revisiting and looking at it with fresh eyes again, like, looking at Belle, she's like a kind of, I don't want to say she's bland or anything, but she is kind of like a straight arrow kind of figure. And that could seem a little, like, almost like lacking in terms of depth of personality. And it's like her passion for books may be seen more as like a crutch or a substitute, but nothing that's really integral to her intellect. I mean, there was actually Michael Barrier was his name, and he actually wrote talking about her her literacy. He said that Belle becomes a sort of intellectual less by actually reading books, it seems, than by hanging out with them. Which I think is very true. I mean, like, you never see, like, her literary knowledge of using it in terms of, like, maybe how she could be able to find her ways of coping with the situation of being in the castle or things like that.
Well, and also the most explicit citations that we have from any of the books that she's reading are ultimately fairy tales about women who find their prince charming.
Yes, when she meets Prince Charming, but she won't discover that it's him till chapter 3.
And then in the Human Again sequence, which was actually animated for the film's 2002 re-release, there's this sequence where she teaches the Beast how to read. And of course, the book that she's using to teach him, it's William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. And I mean, and that's something that's interesting too in thinking about, like, that the film, it not only is kind of very much focusing on these stories about primarily love stories rather than stories about women who are intrepid and industrious and independent thinking, but I mean, as much as that it's, but it's also kind of ignoring a lot of French literature around that time. I mean, just talking about The Green Serpent, for example, in that article for Jezebel that I was sort of alluding to earlier, that it goes into extensive analysis of that story. And in terms of kind of how it sort of reworks the Cupid and Psyche tale, but then kind of repositions it in a way to be a little more about a sense of egalitarianism between the sexes. And in terms of communication, honesty, and reaching that sort of a relationship. And the Disney version tries to do a little bit of that. So I think it's a case of where it's just something that's always been a problem with Disney in terms of being two steps behind the curve.
Yeah, I agree with you, absolutely. And, you know, you're right. I mean, they try to show, for example, like some things, like even though she's in this kind of situation, that she's still kind of stands up to the Beast. Like, there's the scene when, after he rescues her from the wolves and she heals his wounds.
That hurts!
If you'd hold still, it wouldn't hurt as much.
Well, if you hadn't have run away, this wouldn't have happened.
If you hadn't frightened me, I wouldn't have run away.
Well, you shouldn't have been in the West Wing!
Well, you should learn to control your temper.
But it's interesting that you say, too, that, you know, she only chooses to stay with him after he's been brutish to her, after he saves her from this rabid pack of wolves. And the thing that really actually stuck out to me, that's just thinking about the character of the Beast in this version, is that he's not really, I don't know how you would feel about this, but I felt like he's not really beastly as much as he's ornery. I mean, he's a very grumpy, sullen individual who only occasionally you see that he's sort of engaged in this somewhat bestial nature, like when he's attacking the wolves or when he's licking his wounds after that attack. I mean, it's not anything like the Cocteau version where there's that really great Freudian moment of him drinking water out of her cupped hands, you know, or even the fact that his paws are steaming after he hunts and kills a wild animal. And there's all these Freudian psychosexual undercurrents that kind of bubble to the surface in that version, whereas in the Disney version, it's content to kind of either keep them under the surface or just completely omit them. And there are a lot of other deviations from the original tale as well. I mean, the fact, of course, that instead of a merchant, Belle's father is an inventor. And that was something that stuck out to me as well watching this again in terms of thinking about the way that the film codifies difference within the context of kind of social conformity. And I think that that's one aspect that really resonated with a lot of people when Beauty and the Beast first came out. And it's one of the film's strengths, I think, in terms of that it's still trying to tell a story, as I was kind of saying, as I was quoting earlier, about alterity, about otherness, about a sense of being different. And this Disney version really leans hard into that with this dynamic that Belle, and especially her father, Maurice, have within this community that's really kind of portrayed as a monolithic, homogenous entity. They're not really defined by personality as much as they're defined by profession or by what their function is within this town. Whereas there is a little bit of that as well, of course, with the servants and their roles in the castle. But of course, they kind of break out of that role. They subvert what the Beast's commands are, like not to feed Belle. Like he tells them that, you know, if she doesn't eat with me, she doesn't eat at all. What do? They throw a big song and dance number and they give her this grand meal.
Much to the stuffy clock's objections.
Yes, exactly. So there's this, clearly the dynamic that the film's trying to portray here about, like, conformity versus individualism. And I think what helps the film also give its sort of sense of simple but still resonant social critique some weight is the character of Gaston. And I do think that he is, even though, as I noted earlier, that he is stemming from the Cocteau version, that he still has a lot of value as a villain. I think that there's something really, watching the film again, I think he's still one of the greatest Disney villains in terms of just how unexceptional he is. And that's not a critique of the character itself, but just or in terms of like the creation of the character, you know, the work in terms of his depth. But I mean, the fact that he has the only, like, he's this guy who has been put upon a pedestal within this society as this uber mensch, this paragon of heteronormative masculinity. And there's something, I mean, and he's also someone who consequently has never been told no because of that. And so that makes it harder for him to take rejection. And I think that certainly had a lot of poignancy when people first saw that. I mean, to see that this movie is very much about, like, it's a struggle between somebody who has had everything society has ever been able to give them and someone who has been an outcast. And to see that kind of conflict kind of play out, I mean, it was an unusual dynamic in 1991, I feel. But now we've seen a lot more movies kind of build off from what the Disney Beauty and the Beast kind of laid the groundwork
for. Yeah, and I think it's still resonant, that type of antagonist, like what Gaston represents, you know, of that uber machismo and uber masculinity of somebody who can, because they, you know, can't take no for an answer, and they just keep going and going, you know, until they go to the most deranged limits. I mean, we've seen how that still is quite prevalent, you know, in today's society, in a lot of major figures.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, unquestionably. And the great thing about Howard Ashman's lyrics, and I think this will be a great way to segue into the music itself and the songs themselves, but one of my favorite things about the film's lyrical wit is that it does emblematize a lot of that social satire or kind of social critique, you know, particularly in the Mob song, which I think is an underrated song in the context of the film. I mean, there are other songs that are very well known, but I think that one is, it's kind of the clearest in terms of articulating it, especially in its one line about we don't like what we don't understand. In fact, it scares us, but that's very much, but I think it's great that the film is sort of cognizant of that and understanding of that. And in terms of just how, I mean, just what happens when a society is governing itself not on morality, but just this sense of superficial value that it places upon somebody. And then, of course, so there's always now this greater lesson in terms of what do we really value? And in the original fairy tale, it was virtue over wit and beauty. And that's still nominally the same here, but the 91 version tried to kind of modernize that a little bit. And I think that modernization, of course, is also reflected in the film's bombastic Broadway musical numbers. And even more so than The Little Mermaid, I would argue that Beauty and the Beast really drove home kind of the appeal and value of the Disney musical as we kind of understand it. And this, it established the template of it, I feel. I mean, or it really solidified it. I don't know if you feel the same, though.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, as wildly successful as The Little Mermaid was with its music, but I agree with you. Like, I think with Beauty and the Beast, it just that success just elevated even higher. And I think it really made people think, especially because, like, Broadway musicals weren't exactly, like, the most popular. I mean, they had their crowds and audiences, but I think people kind of would see, like, oh, you can actually blend the Broadway musical with the medium of animation, and it would work so well. And I think what also really, what I think separates it from, like, even some of the other Disney animated films that came out during the Renaissance because of the placement of the songs within the story, how the songs are used to tell the story and the characters to move the plot forward. Mm-hmm. You know, and some Disney films that followed afterwards followed that rule, and others just kind of felt more tacked on, you know? But I think that also applies a lot to Mencken, and especially with Ashman and his knowledge and understanding of the musical and of Disney, how both mediums had kind of collaborated before and melded before in the past.
Well, and I think it's interesting that you see a lot of these little cinematic touchstones to bygone musicals, particularly cinematic musicals. Like, you know, the Be Our Guest number has these, you know, choreographed arrangements that look like Busby Berkeley.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but... But I think it's yeah, transposing some of these pre-existing tropes of one sort of medium or genre onto another medium, and then it's like successfully really solidifying that formula is what I think it's what a lot of films try to replicate throughout the rest of the 90s. I mean, both Disney and beyond Disney, and I mean, and then a lot of the films that weren't Disney, they had very, very mixed results in terms of how they could replicate. I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, like, The Swan Princess was not entirely successful.
Anastasia maybe was a little
Anastasia, perhaps. Well, I mean, I was going to say a lot of the Don Bluth films from that decade really tried to lean heavily into capturing that lightning in a bottle magic that Beauty and the Beast had. And it didn't... They couldn't quite replicate it as successfully.
Well, you know, even if you take out all the imitators aside, you know, like... do you feel like, having seen it again now, as we near our 30th birthday, do you feel like this movie still holds up 30 years later, you know, legacy aside and all that?
I mean, aside from the legacy of its imitators, I would say that Beauty and the Beast, I still value it as a film within, I mean, of course it's difficult to separate nostalgia from this as well, because... it was a formative film in our youth, and we, you know, grew up watching it and rewatching it and really understanding it, kind of the template of how to convey visual storytelling in terms of storyboarding, in terms of cinematography as well. I mean, just there's some great kind of gothic atmospheric lighting in this film.
Yeah, there's watching again, I was noting all the like high angle far off shots of it, which are like really striking to really
high angle wide shots. Yeah. But here's the thing too, that I think, But here's the other thing, too. But now, having watched other films since then, and coming back to it now, I do think that Beauty and the Beast, I feel like it's aged in a way that it now feels like it's set the template, and what once seemed cutting edge, now, I think, like a lot of Disney output, seems a little antiquated. I think it's aged better than some of the more egregious examples I could think of in terms of Disney's output over the many, many years they've been working, but I mean, I do think that there are moments where the film kind of, it doesn't lean into some of the more potential for subversion that I think Cocteau really masterfully pulled together. I mean, you know, thinking about the ending of the story, of course, where the Beast transforms into the prince, and Janet Maslin, actually, in her review of the Disney version, she was remarking upon a certain disappointment at this sort of, she was saying, like a bland handsomeness that the Beast transformed into. And I think what's so great about the Cocteau version is how Cocteau understands that limitation of the story, and he deliberately makes us, the audience, feel disappointed with that. That there's this, ultimately, something really tragic, even though they live happily ever after, but there's a tragedy that they only live happily ever after by conforming to these pre-established notions of beauty, even though the story is trying to, of course, say, oh, beauty exists from within, but of course that's sort of undermined. Whereas other movies like Shrek, which would come out 10 years later, and even though that's in itself aged pretty markedly, it tried to kind of, it was a film that was in response to the Disney version of Beauty and the Beast in terms of subverting that component and trying to kind of really interrogate a little bit more of the limitations of the tale. And I think there are other kind of versions of, by Angela Carter specifically, that really kind of turn the tale upside down and shake it to its core. Whereas the Disney version, it's limited, of course, because it's a Disney film. And I do think that there are, and you can feel kind of course, the schematics of the story. I mean, of course, you have to have the side characters, you have to have these, you know, a particular sort of pacing. I mean, even though I think it's beautifully animated, I think the architecture of the castle was always impressive. But coming back to it now, I don't know how you felt, but I feel like the castle is almost sort of, it's safely gothic. Whereas as we were talking about earlier with the Cocteau version, that one feels like you step inside this completely otherworldly realm.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, and I think, you know, there always will be that kind of safe spot for Disney, you know, which makes sense because it's such a huge corporation. But, you know, and even though it has the age has sort of appeared on this version, but, you know, taking nostalgia aside, I still have an affinity for the film because, you know, it's still I still look back on it and it kind of makes me think about like some of I think it's one of the first movies that kind of inserted my passion for cinema and kind of made me realize I wanted to be a filmmaker. I wanted to work in animation because they're still looking at whether it's the background paintings of the interior of the castle or the beautiful Al Menken score or even some of the character animation. Like, I do agree with Chuck Jones. Like, I think the character animation of The Beast by supervising animator Glenn Keane, who is a I just want to say he's a phenomenal artist, and I think this is some of his best work with this character. There's still moments with The Beast that are like, they still impress me to this day. And again, just all that just reminds me of like why I wanted to make movies in the first place.
Right, right. No, I mean, I think, no, I mean, my feeling about Beauty and the Beast, the Disney version, is that it was a necessary film to watch in our youth. And I think it was... And it's been a formative film for a lot of people who grew up watching it. I think that's great, you know, because I think it's a very well-crafted piece of entertainment.
It is. And I also feel like what I think makes it still hold up more often than not is the passion that was put in this project by everyone involved.
Well, yes. But I just want to say that I think that some of the film's attempts at modernization do fall a little flat. I mean, for example, I do think this whole kind of the use of trying to frame Belle as an intellectual, but without actually directing that intellectualism towards any sort of, you know, function within the plot. I mean, aside from the library scene, which in itself, I think, has been justly critiqued in a lot of media, of course. But I think, for example, like that, it superficially kind of, it gives sort of like this sort of... something of a credence to intellectualism, but it doesn't go beyond a superficial exploration of it. And I think that while this version of Beauty and the Beast is certainly worth seeing and certainly worth revisiting time and again, I don't know about the remake. I've still never seen the 2017 version.
I've seen the remake. I don't think it's worth your time. Like, it tries to even, be progressive, and it tries to add some other components to it, but it just feels very inconsequential to the whole tapestry of it, and it just never comes into its own thing. You know, it's not worth your time. I know there are fans of it, but I'm not one of those fans.
Well, I mean, and so I would just say then that I mean I'm glad that I've stuck with the original Beauty and the Beast, at least the original Disney Beauty and the Beast. But what I'm glad about it is that it, like you, I think it really laid a lot of the foundation for my sort of interest in cinema and animation and fusing color, camera movement, music to tell a very visually dynamic and affecting story. And even these moments of quiet emotional poignancy, you know, which to me was kind of an interesting thing rewatching the film in terms of how rushed it felt to me at certain points. Like certain moments that I felt had stuck more out, like this moment where the Beast enacts mercy on Gaston. It felt even more rushed, even though I think it's a great moment.
And again, wonderful animation.
Well, wonderful animation. It's fantastic character animation. But I think the function of Beauty and the Beast for me is that it laid the groundwork, and from that groundwork, I've discovered even more and better films. So, but I'm still glad it exists, and I'm still glad that it, you know, that it, that, I just think it does, it's a part of something greater, and I don't think that it stands as quite the pinnacle of artistic achievement in the medium of animation as perhaps it was once viewed, or it still is viewed, I'd say, by many other people, but that's just me, in my opinion.
I don't think it's the greatest animated film of all time. I wouldn't go quite that far, but I still think it's a very good film. And I do think that I think there was a lot of people who I think will respond to at least something in the film. You know, there's something there, so to speak.
Well, and that's a good point. And we'll always have the score which is it is one of the best movie musicals of the last 30 years.
And I mean, like, I wish that, you know, and you know, I do wish Howard Ashman had lived to, he never lived to see the finished film. Like, he saw an in progress version, but, you know, and there's this very kind of sad story where, you know, after they kind of promoted the film to some people and they went to tell Howard, it was like the last time he was in a Baltimore hospital, you know, he couldn't see, he had barely a whisper of a voice. And so they just told him, and then they said the goodbyes. And producer Don Hahn recalled, like, he leaned over to him and he said to him, you know, this movie's going to be such a huge success. Who would have thunk it? And Howard lit up and whispered, I would have.
On behalf of Howard, I know if he were here, he'd want to thank Angela Lansbury for her incomparable performance of the song in the movie as Mrs. Potts, and also Celine Dion and Peabo Bryson for their performance. Also thanks to Walter A. and Robbie Buchanan for their work on the single. And accepting for Howard will be Bill Lau. Thanks, Alan. Howard and I shared a home and a life together, and I'm very happy and very proud to accept this for him. But it is bittersweet. This is the first Academy Award given to someone we've lost to AIDS. In working on Beauty and the Beast, Howard faced incredible personal challenges, but always gave his best. And what made that possible was an atmosphere of understanding, love, and support. That's something everyone facing AIDS not only needs, but deserves. There's an inscription at Howard's grave in Baltimore. It reads, "Oh, that he had one more song to sing." We'll never hear that song, but I'm deeply grateful for this tribute you've given to what he left behind. For Howard, I thank you.
On that note, I think we should transition into thinking about other movies that we've caught up with this week, even though Beauty and the Beast is a great one, and it's a great one for Valentine's Day. But the world of cinema is an expansive leviathan that we constantly try to tackle on this show with recommendations of the week. And I wanted to ask you, Alex, I know that we've been focusing a lot on Beauty and the Beast, but have there been any movies that you've seen lately that you would recommend?
Yes, I actually have seen a film that I would like to recommend. And one of the things it does have in common is it also was made by an artist who sadly also succumbed to AIDS in the 1990s. And I also wanted to talk about this film because I was looking for a film because it's Black History Month. So I wanted to look at something that would fall into that category as well. So I decided to look up actually an auteur named Marlon Riggs, who was an African-American director as well as poet. And I was watching one of his documentaries called Color Adjustment, which made its premiere at the 1992 Sundance Film Festival before it aired on the PBS series POV, where it has received critical praise at the time. It won a Peabody Award and still regarded as a great documentary to this day. And I thought, and I really, really liked this one too. I mean, this documentary, it covers basically like around the first 40 years from like when television started to become like really a mainstream commodity for the American public in terms of entertainment, especially in regards to like African-American representation. And it discusses about all these shows and sort of their, you know, their limitations, their setbacks, and or like their progressive values, like all the way from Amos and Andy to The Cosby Show. And it's really fascinating to like watch these and how they kind of can serve as a reflection of like sort of the mindset, the cultural mindset and attitude of the American people, you know, and in terms of like how viewing about like with the African Americans in this country who are struggling to attain their civil rights, especially after the end of the Second Civil War, I mean, the Second World War. And so it was very fascinating for me to watch and to see like all these, it's particularly, you know, when you have some shows which maybe were considered a little too progressive for the time and consequently were canceled prematurely. Like, for example, there was a show from the late 80s, which there's one called Frank's Place, which ran for only one season. But that probably was a little too, like, maybe hit too hard to the bone in terms of its critiques on, like, systemic racism or, like, racial problems in America. But then how you have other shows that may seem progressive, like Roots, you know, this is considered a big one. But it's like, you know, yes, it did have people, you know, after episodes aired, like white and black people would get together and discuss about the history of slavery in this country. But You know, but the setback, he argues, is that it still shows like, oh, but, you know, there's still the family comes together and tries to fulfill the myth of the American dream, which is a common trait that that Riggs explores throughout the film, about the myth of the American dream and how it was translated into the medium of television. And I think it's very fascinating and reflective to think about, especially now, almost 30 years after Riggs had made this film, and thinking about like how far television has or has not really come, you know, in terms of like that portrayal of like not just race, but also about American, you know, accessible means of living, you know. And so I actually would say it's I think it's an essential piece of American documentary cinema.
Well, I mean, it's really interesting that you're kind of bringing this up. I haven't seen the film myself, but just kind of bringing up just the notion about queer artists working in cinema, and because we've been talking a little bit about Howard Ashman, I mean, I think one of the things, just thinking about Beauty and the Beast, that's sort of interesting because we were kind of talking about it as like a story about cultural othering as well. And I'm sure that that's, and of course, like the film can be read, or the story can be read, but particularly this film version can be read as sort of speaking in communication to a lot of that sort of, that prejudice that was happening, that continues to happen still, towards people within the LGBTQ plus community. I mean, I'm sure that it's, and I think, but I mean, Ashman was very clever about kind of incorporating that within the framework of a major corporation like Disney that has to kind of kowtow to more conservative values. And what's interesting about Marlon Riggs, from what you've been kind of describing, is that he didn't have a lot of those concerns, that he was much more free to be overt in addressing a lot of these conservative values of kind of, yeah, I'm just sort of, not just when you say the American dream, but it sounds like what you're also talking about is the affirmation of the nuclear family.
Exactly. Like he talks, like the details of the American dream include like having, you know, a nice house, you know, having the nuclear family, being together. And, you know, and again, it's like how, you know, he kind of then critiques it specifically, like in the 80s, for example, he does explicitly talk about President Reagan's trickle-down economics policy, which has proven to, you know, be ineffective against, and to really damaging towards the working class people in this country.
Well, right, of course. I mean, well, that's interesting then that he's speaking more, I mean, beyond just simply just, it sounds like he's speaking beyond mere representation of race in media, but as well as just thinking about how figures from media like Ronald Reagan, who really was kind of the, arguably like, you know, JFK was the first president to really master the persona on television, but Reagan really got it down in terms of this image that he created for himself and how he sold a product to the American people, and that product was neoliberalism, and it did disproportionately impact people of color and LGBTIQ plus Americans as well. That sounds like a really fascinating film.
It's currently streaming on the Criterion website, and I highly recommend, if you're looking for a great documentary to watch for Black History Month, then I definitely say check this one out.
Fantastic. I wanted to kind of, for my recommendation of the week, I wanted to kind of stray away from a little bit of what we've been talking about to actually pay, kind of stay a little more in the one aspect of what we've been talking about in terms of filmmakers or storytellers of French origin. Because we've, these last, I mean, we always lose great talent and venerated legends at any given year. But I feel like in particular these last couple of weeks, we've lost a lot of really talented people. I mean, between Christopher Plummer, Cloris Leachman, Cicely Tyson.
Hal Holbrook.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's been pretty rough, you know, to see a lot of these stalwarts of cinema disappearing. And one of them, who we just lost not that long ago, was the writer, Jean-Claude Carrière. And he was a completely, I mean, for anyone who's unfamiliar with his work, he is one of the most prolific screenwriters of the second half of the 20th century in French cinema, though he did work in a very broad range of, he worked for an eclectic number of filmmakers. He worked with Nagisa Oshima, for Maximum Amour, which I've still never seen, but I'm curious about, you know, any love story with Charlotte Rampling and a gorilla.
Yeah, I've seen that, and it's quite an interesting film, to say the least.
Well, he also co-wrote, he had a hand in writing the Jonathan Glazer film Birth, which I think is kind of underrated, but I know that it's sort of a somewhat contested film in a lot of respects. But clearly the most famous person that he ever worked with was Louis Buñuel. And they both spent close to 20 years working together on several feature films. They made six feature films together, beginning with Diary of a Chambermaid, and a lot of the films that they've made are considered among Buñuel's seminal classics. And I could talk about any of them. I could talk about Belle du Jour. I could recommend The Milky Way. But the one that I saw the other week that I think is really indicative of their talents and their process of writing is 1974's The Phantom of Liberty. And something I never knew about them both was that both Carrière and Buñuel, they spent nearly the entirety of their collaboration, every day they would get up and they would kind of work on the scripts that they were working on, but they would always make time every day to tell each other stories. And these could be stories about what their dreams were, or stories they would just make up on the spot. They were creative exercises. And I think that that's important to note, because The Phantom of Liberty is, in a lot of respects, a series of loosely connected stories. It's a free associative, disorienting collage of these somewhat bawdry, very, very funny, but loosely connected tales. So, for example, I'll give you kind of an idea of how the film moves along. It opens primarily on this live-action reenactment of Goya's seminal modernist painting, The 3rd of May, 1808, wherein several Spanish rebels are executed by a firing squad from Napoleon's soldiers. And the film kind of takes that, and then before we kind of realize, once we kind of get settled into this sort of this setting, we suddenly cut to the present day, where we realize that this era is being read about in a book by a woman in a park. And she's a nanny who's looking after two children in a park. They're approached by this somewhat lascivious man who shows them photographs, but tells them not to show anyone else. They bring the photographs back to the household, and their bourgeois parents sees the photographs and look at them, and we realize that the photographs are actually just of famous French architecture. And they just keep saying, disgusting. Oh, that's scandalous. And then that night, the husband in the couple has a dream that includes their bedroom being besieged upon by an ostrich, or an emu, I should say, and a bicycle carrier. The next day he goes to the doctor, tries to tell him about these dreams that he keeps having. But then, before we kind of understand what these can even be about, then we follow this nurse who has to go visit her sick father. And as she kind of bikes along home, then she, and blah, 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 and so on and so forth. And you get an idea of how Buñuel and Carrière take us along this long, winding, very peculiar adventure in this film. And again, like, they were used to being adventurous filmmakers, most overtly with The Milky Way being a road picture. But by de-emphasizing any psychological identification with a particular central character, Carrière and Buñuel, they thrust their audience into what is an ostensibly anarchic universe. And it's one that's inundated with minor figures who are named after major postmodernist figures. For example, there's a doctor in the film who's named Dr. Pierre Pasolini. Ha ha ha. The targets, though, of the film's warped satire are any perceived institutions that uphold social mores, including organized religion and bourgeois enclaves. And these subjects have been lampooned in other Buñuel Carrière collaborations. I mean, most notably, The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie and That Obscure Object of Desire, both of which preceded and succeeded The Phantom of Liberty, respectively. But this film stands alone, I think, because of it is a structural and formal extension of Buñuel and Carrière's wary regard for societal norms that tend to obfuscate our more primal natures and impulses. I mean, for example, there's a brilliant sequence where an assassin who's been needlessly murdering people from a multi-story window, he's tried and convicted for the murder of all of these innocent bystanders. He is sentenced to die, and as soon as he's sentenced, he steps outside of the courtroom into the lobby, where he's greeted by ardorous fans looking for autographs. It's something that I think is frankly chilling in the way it predates Altman's Nashville as this eerily prescient satire of cultural exaltation of serial killers in several Western nations. But the genius of the films that Carrière and Buñuel made together lies in something of a cohesive vision that's supported by this singular and not easily definable element of free associative impish energy. And I think that The Phantom of Liberty is tethered ultimately by a pervasive feeling of isolation. And that isolation can be from history, from our base urges and fundamental nature, as well as from each other. And the film doesn't posit a possible escape from a cycle that traps us and condemns us to repeat our struggles for and from freedom, but it can only observe the capacity we possess to dream within these limited constructs. It's a giggly, perversive, and frequently troubling but disarmingly brilliant masterwork of late 20th century surrealism, well worth revisiting now that both of its creators have left us. I can't say I quite understood all of it, but I'm certainly looking forward to watching it again. And it has one of the great toilet jokes in all of cinema.
Better than Dumb and Dumber's toilet?
Yeah. Undoubtedly.
Only on this podcast you'll hear us compare the Farley brothers unjustly to Buñuel.
Well, who knows? Who knows? Maybe there's a video essay that can kind of come from that at some point.
Yeah, but, you know, what I love about their collaborations, because I have seen some of the films they've done together, and I do love how they do talk about these themes about, like, conservatism and about religion and doing it through, like, more often than not, a surreal and dreamlike that turns into sort of a nightmare escape kind of lens, but also with a cheeky sense of humor as well.
It's steeped very much in these serious inquiries of religion and politics, but at the same time, you know, for example, we'll have a group of Carmelite monks playing poker and associating, you know, something like a Holy Virgin with like a nine of clubs while they're smoking cigars. So it zigs where you think it zags, and certainly I think a movie like The Phantom of Liberty has more creativity in 10 minutes alone than most movies have in their entire runtime. So for the adventurous viewer, absolutely. And any connoisseur of French cinema, it's absolutely worth seeking out if you haven't seen it before.
Well, I'll definitely check it out. And is it also on the Criterion Channel?
Of course.
Well, thank you so much, everyone, for listening to this episode. We hope you enjoyed it, and hope you have a wonderful Valentine's Day.
Absolutely. I mean, by the time you hear this, it'll be past Valentine's Day. Hopefully, we get this out before President's Day. This is a very peculiar President's Day episode, but thank you. Yeah, if you have any comments about different versions of Beauty and the Beast, I think that's always a great wellspring for conversation, and we're always looking to hear people's thoughts on the themes that have been extrapolated from all the various versions that have come out since the tale was first published. But until then, we will be planning out more films to talk about from our 91 series. In the meantime, though, as always, be well, stay safe, and continue watching great movies.
Take care, and remember, we are all in this together.